Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. It's my pleasure to announce Dr. Akhil Palasamy is a Harvard-trained physician who practices integrative medicine, incorporating the best of conventional medicine and alternative therapies. A holistic doctor, he completed his pre-medical training in biochemistry at Harvard University, received his medical degree from the University of California, San Francisco, and completed his residency in family medicine at Stanford University. He also completed a fellowship in integrative medicine with Dr. Andrew Weil at the University of Arizona, and is certified by the Center for Mind-Body Medicine at Georgetown University. Dr. Akhil practices at the Institute for Health and Healing in San Francisco, one of the oldest centers for integrative medicine in the United States. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much, Patty, for the kind introduction, and thank you all for coming out tonight on this rainy evening. So it's really a pleasure to be with all of you tonight. And I have a lot of information to cover, so we're going to go ahead and get started. So the first slide is going to talk about this theme of evolutionary mismatch, which is the idea that everything that we do from the time we wake up until the time we go to sleep is completely different from the way that we evolved to live as human beings. So this includes how much, how we're getting our food, what kind of food we are eating, how much time we're spending outdoors, physical activity, stress levels, how much sleep we get. So this is something that affects everyone in the modern world. You know, it affects you, it affects me. And so what are the consequences of this concept known as evolutionary mismatch? So the researcher at Harvard, Daniel Lieberman, who's an evolutionary biologist, actually found that a lot of our modern medical problems, including obesity and heart disease, as well as dementia, diabetes, hypertension, and he is a big researcher in the barefoot running movement, which is athletes that run without shoes, because there are certain societies where that was practiced widely. So he's found that a large number of our modern problems that we're dealing with can be traced back to this evolutionary mismatch. And this is a timeline about early human history, which shows you that over the first about 4 million years of human history, we evolved as hunter-gatherers with that sort of diet and lifestyle. And very recently, just about 10,000 years ago, agriculture began, and we started having grains. And then in the very recent past, in the last 100 years, we have our modern processed foods. And 4 million years of evolution has not really prepared us to be eating these foods. So before we go into nutrition, I want you to help me solve a mystery. And this mystery is the epidemic of myopia or nearsightedness that's taking place all around the world in our young people, especially pronounced in Asia. So myopia basically refers to poor vision that requires glasses to correct. So among our young people, this is becoming actually epidemic. And you may not realize it because it seems like such an innocuous thing. But actually, this was published in the journal Nature, which is one of the top scientific journals in the world. So in the 1940s, the rates of myopia were in the range of 20% for most countries where they've been keeping records. And in the past 70 years, it's gone up to over 80% in all of these countries. So obviously, this is not a genetic cause because, you know, evolution happens over millions of years, not 70 years. But why has the incidence of myopia quadrupled in just such a short amount of time? And it's especially pronounced in younger people, as we talked about. So you might think this is pretty benign, just more people are wearing glasses. But actually, myopia carries with it, in severe cases, an increased risk of glaucoma, cataracts, and retinal detachment. So it's not a totally benign condition. So here are the things that have been ruled out in terms of causes of this epidemic. So, your mother might have told you, don't sit too close to the TV, that's going to ruin your eyes. Completely not true. So you can sit as close to the TV as you want. Maybe it's because everybody is in school and reading so much. You know, everybody's reading books all the time. Well, there's actually one factor that if that is correctly done, it doesn't really matter how much time a child reads, how many hours a child reads a book every day. That's actually not the factor. You might think it's because of all the times that kids now spend on screens, you know, with their computers and their mobile devices, their iPads. But in reality, that's not the cause either. So what scientists have found is actually the primary cause of this epidemic is our lack of exposure to sunlight, and especially true among children. So why is that? The reason is that sunlight actually stimulates the release of dopamine in the retina, which is the back of the eye. And myopia is a problem. It's a structural problem. Basically, the eye doesn't grow properly. And as a result, the image that's coming in doesn't focus on the retina, the back of the eye. It focuses somewhere in front because the shape of the eyeball is wrong. And that's why you need glasses to correct where this image lands. So basically, dopamine in the retina is produced in a circadian rhythm. So there's a certain amount in the daytime, certain amount at night. And sunlight is actually the cue that triggers the correct amount of dopamine. So if a child is not exposed to enough sunlight every day, over time, this cycle is disrupted and the eye does not grow properly. And so scientists have shown that it's pretty conclusive that boosting outdoor time literally helps reduce these rates of myopia in children. So in Singapore, this led to a public service campaign where they have this slogan, "Keep myopia away, go outdoors and play." And they were trying to encourage everyone in Singapore to, especially the children, to go outside and play and, you know, spend time outdoors. So it's not a physical activity outdoors. So it doesn't matter if the child is, you know, playing or playing a sport or just sitting and, you know, doing nothing, but it's literally the amount of time outdoors, the amount of number of hours of sunlight. And the studies show that it's on average about 2 to 3 hours of sunlight per day, which is the minimum needed for children to maintain good eyesight. So that works out to about 15 to 20 hours a week. So how many children do you know who are getting 15 to 20 hours a week outdoors? So okay, and other well-established benefits of sunlight include vitamin D. So your skin makes vitamin D when you're outdoors. And this is very important for bone health, for immune function, preventing cancer, and also brain health. And sunlight, of course, regulates our circadian rhythm and sleep. So for people with sleep difficulties, time spent outdoors during the day getting exposed to sunlight actually helps them sleep better at night. And that's been conclusively proven. So there's a lot of other benefits to sunlight. One of the newest things that's been found is that sunlight directly stimulates your immune system. So this was a study which showed that your T cells, which are part of your immune system that fights off infections, literally move faster when you are outside and exposed to sunlight. So it all comes back to this basic idea that we evolved growing up, you know, with a lot of time outdoors. And so it's not surprising that there are all these benefits which accrue from the simple free factor of getting exposed to sunlight. So we're going to go back to the topic of nutrition, and we're going to discuss the first factor is evolution of our fiber intake over the many years. So as we talked about, for millions of years, we were hunting and gathering, and the best estimate of how much fiber we used to get, how much fiber our digestive system evolved with, is in the range of 100 to 150 grams per day. So after about 10,000 years when agriculture developed, that was still pretty substantial, although it dropped quite a bit. So average at, for agrarian lifestyle was about 35 grams. So these farmers and agriculturists were eating much less, but still significantly higher than what we're eating today with our processed, the SAD diet is known as the Standard American Diet, for people who don't know the acronym. So 15 grams. So we've literally dropped about 90% from 150 grams to 15 grams. And this is completely different from what our GI tracts evolved with and, you know, the fiber that feeds your beneficial bacteria and, you know, and all these other factors. So one other big change in terms of nutrition is plant diversity. And so the number of different plant species consumed in most hunter-gatherer societies was in the range of 100 to 120 per year. And every day, typically, they might get 15 to 20 different species of fruits and vegetables. And most people today are only eating about 8 to 10 in the entire year. So just because you get in the same habit, the same routine, and you don't necessarily think about expanding the diversity of the kinds of vegetables and plants you're eating. But again, it's about a 90% drop from 100 different kinds per year to just about 10. So this is very important for the microbiome, which is the beneficial bacteria in your gut. And 60% of your immune system is in your gut. So the gut, largely controls the immune system. And if you're not having this plant diversity, the diversity of your microbiome also drops a great deal. And that's one of the reasons why there's such an epidemic of autoimmune diseases, in this country, as well as other problems with chronic inflammation. So we're going to focus a lot more on nutrition for the rest of the night. But before we do that, I want to ask you, what do you think is the best predictor of early death in this slide among these three factors? So would you believe that it's obesity? Would you believe it's physical inactivity or loneliness? And these are all actually fairly good predictors of early death, but the best one is loneliness. And this is something that also is an evolutionary mismatch, because we evolved in groups of 20 to 30 members in a tribe with very close social contact and connection. And there are modern blue zone societies. These blue zones are areas around the world where there's exceptional longevity, where the population lives about 10 or 15 years more than other people in the same country, and there are about 6 or 7 of these spots around the world. And one thing that they all have in common, they all eat completely different diets. So, each of them eats a completely different diet, but they all have very high priority on meaningful social connections, spending literally a few hours every day in meaningful social time, quality time. Physical activity is the other thing, of course, that they all have in common, but it just illustrates the importance and the effects of this this social connection. Now, currently, rates of loneliness, as reported in questionnaires, are at their highest levels worldwide, and we have, of course, more technology than ever, so we're more wired than ever, but perhaps more disconnected than ever. And you might think, this is really not a big deal. Why am I talking about this? About 100 years ago, we used to read our newspapers and wait for the horse-drawn carriage to pull up. And then now we're reading on our cell phones and just waiting for our cars, right? So is this really, a big difference? It shouldn't be. But the thing is that the means by which we connect to other people, even those that are right next to you or within walking distance, they're going digital. And as a result, I like this quote, which says that conversation is changing and sometimes going away for good. And so I think it's just important to use technology mindfully and be aware of the effect that it has on, on that social connection. And just remember to connect in person with other people as well, in addition to connecting online. So it's something that has a really big impact on health. So what is the solution to evolutionary mismatch? Well, the solution is very simple. It's living the way that you evolved to live. And in the most general sense, that involves eating a healthy diet, which we're going to focus on for the rest of the evening, movement and physical activity, getting adequate rest and sleep, connecting with others, and managing your stress. So in my approach, which I call the Paleo-Vedic approach, I've gone into more detail with each of these aspects. So the focus of that is a nutrient-dense paleo diet that is customized for your Ayurvedic body type, and we'll talk about how to do that, and also includes an emphasis on spices, as well as detoxification and other practices like fasting and maintaining a mind-body balance. So why use a paleo diet as the foundation? Well, as we talked about, we've all lived over 100,000 generations as hunter-gatherers in our ancestry, and only 400 generations with agriculture and farming. And evolution occurs over millions of years. So our body, although it is, you know, adapting in some ways, it's not anywhere near adapted to our modern diet. And what was the original paleo diet that was eaten by our ancestors? Well, it was primarily wild plant foods, which includes leaves, tubers, roots, as well as fruits and nuts and legumes, and also meat and fish when it was available, which it was not, you know, most of the time. But was paleo low carb? And this is something which is a popular misconception that people think about when they think of the paleo diet. But in reality, the true paleo diet was not low carb because starchy plants like tubers, which were high in beneficial carbohydrates, were consumed for hundreds of thousands of years, even before agriculture produced grains. So these starchy plants were, you know, the foundation of the paleo diet for many years. And of course, meat and fish were hard to catch and not easily available. Now, legumes are another area of controversy, which legumes includes, you know, beans. And many people in the paleo community believe that the paleo diet did not include legumes. But in reality, the anthropological evidence shows that a lot of hunter-gatherers did consume legumes, including those from Africa, Australia, and, you know, certain Native Americans all consumed different types of legumes. And one of the concerns with legumes is something known as anti-nutrients. And these are compounds that make legumes hard to digest, and it's one of the reasons why they're avoided by some in the paleo community. But in fact, if you soak legumes for 12 to 24 hours, you can remove most of those anti-nutrients, which include phytates, tannins, and lectins, and improve the digestibility of legumes, and also make sure that you're getting all of the nutrients, like the protein and the vitamins and minerals. So legumes were definitely part of the original paleo diet and part of my recommendation with the paleo-Vedic diet. So what about meat? There was a study which looked at over 200 different hunter-gatherer populations to estimate what they were eating, and it found that basically whenever they had the opportunity to eat animal foods, they would consume it, you know, as much as they could. And they typically did eat the whole animal. So it's unlike what we eat today, which are mostly, you know, muscle meats and that kind of thing. They would eat what's called nose to tail, you know, literally every part of the animal, the organs, the bones would be boiled to extract the nutrients, and not much would be left except the bones. So typically, that's a very different way of consuming meat, but they did eat the whole animal. And they had a higher intake of protein than our modern diet, so between 20 to 35% of calories, and also slightly lower intake of carbohydrates in the range of probably 30 to 40%. So it's not a low-carb diet, but because wild plants were so low in sugar, you know, their total intake of carbohydrates was lower. Compared to our modern diet, where we're probably getting maybe 50% of calories from carbohydrates, and with protein maybe in the range of 10 to 15%. So this is how the ancestral diet differed from our modern diet in terms of macronutrients. So whenever I tell people I've written a book about, you know, I call it the paleo-Vedic diet, they say, oh, you mean meat, because that's the popular conception of paleo diet. Paleo diet is just meat. But you know, I think that paleo should be a plant-based diet, and the majority of food should be fruits and vegetables, you know, what's on your plate, even if you do eat meat. So that was part of my thinking and reasoning behind the book, is that I really thought there was a lot of value in the paleo approach for all these reasons. One of the great values is actually what you take out. So when people go paleo, there's a bunch of things they usually remove initially, and that includes refined grains, vegetable seed oils like soybean oil and corn oil, you know, those kind of things, and trans fats. So removing those things out of your diet is, you know, one of the best starting points in terms of the paleo approach. And what I saw in my practice, you know, with patients was that sometimes people eating paleo were actually doing themselves some harm with the way they were following it. So they were consuming much fewer carbohydrates than they needed, or not adapting their diet to different life circumstances, or they were following a diet that was not ideal for their Ayurvedic body type, which we will talk about. For example, eating too much raw food for certain body types is not recommended. And that's why I think paleo is only a starting point and should be a template, but it has to be customized and personalized in order to really be effective. So let's talk a little bit more about the nutrient-dense part of my approach, the paleo-Vedic approach, which starts with a customized nutrient-dense paleo diet. So what do I mean by nutrient-dense? Well, there's basically, we're talking about micronutrients, and there's two kinds of micronutrients, vitamins and minerals, and phytochemicals. So these micronutrients are what protect us against disease. So there are primary defense against all diseases, vitamins, minerals, and phytochemicals. And as we talked about, you know, we've lost so many of these over the years. So my approach is really to choose the most nutrient-dense fruits and vegetables and also incorporate spices, which are very rich in all of these micronutrients. So as we talked about earlier, you know, are the wild plants that are the ancestors of our modern fruits and vegetables were very different. They were, you know, lower in sugar. They were smaller, more fibrous, less attractive, and you know, less sweet. And scientists are now studying almost 40,000 different phytochemicals that are protective against disease. So there's a large number of these phytochemicals that are, you know, really important. And what is the difference between wild foods and modern foods? So let's take the common apple. And on the left here, we have some wild apples from Asia. And then here on the right is the modern ginger gold apple, which is one of the best-selling apples in the United States today. And I'm sure you know that the wild apples have more nutrients, more phytochemicals. But what is the percentage difference? You know, is it 20% more, 50% more, or, you know, 100% more? Well, actually, the percent difference is 47,500. So literally, an ounce of these apples have 475 times the amount of antioxidants as an ounce of the ginger gold apple. So it's like you're, you know, compare, now you have, it's almost like apples and oranges, you know, it's, even though they're both apples, the difference between them is so striking. And this is why I believe that, you know, we can't tell people to just eat more fruits and vegetables, because if they're eating the wrong kinds, you know, maybe they're not really helping themselves as much. So what are some tips for boosting the phytochemical intake? Well, a rough guideline is the more deeply and intensely colored a plant is, the more phytonutrients it contains. So these bright colors are all caused by different phytochemicals. And this is the reason why they have the recommendation to eat the rainbow, because if you're getting all these different colored, you know, fruits and vegetables, you're automatically getting a diverse array of different phytochemicals. Now, phytochemicals in plants are generally how they defend themselves. So, you know, all plants have to protect themselves against, you know, pests, against sunlight, radiation. And so all of those things are usually attacking the surface of plants, like fruits. So most of the fruit or vegetables' antioxidants are either in the skin or just below the surface. And we're going to look at this example with an avocado. So I'm not sure how many of you had noticed, but when you slice open an avocado, if you look just below the peel, there's a layer of flesh which is dark green, which is darker than the surrounding flesh, and it is this part of the avocado that is actually the highest in nutrients, so the highest in antioxidants. And you can tell by the color because it's, you know, it's darker. So that's a simple trick to get more out of your avocados. You can make sure that you're scraping the skin well and getting those that flesh that's, you know, darker than the surrounding flesh. So let's look at a few big categories of vegetables to talk about exactly how to eat with more nutrient density. So when it comes to lettuce, Iceberg lettuce is the number one lettuce that's consumed in the United States today, and it's very low in phytochemicals. It's very high in fiber and water, but beyond that, it's very low in phytochemicals. Whereas, in contrast, romaine lettuce actually has about four times the antioxidants of regular iceberg lettuce. So that's a simple substitution where if you're getting more leafy greens, romaine lettuce would be a preferable option. Here are some other options when we're talking about leafy greens, because that's probably one of the most important categories of vegetables, you know, leafy greens. So arugula is excellent, and that peppery flavor that you taste when you're eating arugula reflects certain phytochemicals which are really health-promoting. Radicchio is also an excellent option when it comes to leafy greens and salads. And loose-leaf lettuce, either green loose-leaf lettuce or red loose-leaf lettuce, all of these are far superior to iceberg lettuce. So for your salads and sandwiches, these would be, you know, much preferred in terms of phytochemicals. Now, the number one vegetable worldwide that's consumed is actually cabbage, and it's green cabbage. But if you just look at the example of red cabbage, you're actually getting six times the phytochemicals of green cabbage. So just choosing the red variety of cabbage will allow you to get, you know, 600% more antioxidants than consuming green cabbage. So that's a pretty easy substitution. This is a picture I took at my local farmer's market with cauliflower. And cauliflower is one exception to the color rule, because even the white cauliflower is very nutritious. So the cauliflower is very rich in glucosinolates, which are cancer-fighting compounds. But the purple cauliflower actually has three times as many of those as the white cauliflower. So definitely white cauliflower is excellent, but the purple cauliflower is the top among cauliflowers in terms of phytochemical content. Now, moving on to onions. So, the large, juicy, sweet white onions that you sometimes get in the stores are very different from how onions were, you know, over hundreds and thousands of years ago. So the red onions are a better option than white onions because of that color rule. They have more phytochemicals. And actually, the kind of onion that's the most nutrient dense is a little bit surprising. It's the green onion, or also known as scallions. And green onions actually have 140 times as many phytochemicals as a white onion. And the reason why is that green onions are very close to how wild onions used to be, where the bulb was very small and they were mostly greens. And these these green onions give you a tremendous amount of beneficial phytochemicals, and they're very close to how wild onions were. So this is another way to, you know, increase your phytochemical intake. And then lastly, when it comes to tomatoes, you can guess that the smaller tomatoes, the cherry and grape tomatoes, are much higher in phytochemicals than the larger tomatoes, the beefsteak tomatoes, and tomatoes, which came much later. And the reason why there's a can of tomato sauce in this slide is because with certain vegetables, you actually get more nutrients out of them when they're cooked, and certain vegetables are better for you raw. So tomatoes are actually in the former category, where they're better for you cooked. So the one best source of lycopene on this slide with different tomatoes is actually the tomato sauce, because cooking tomatoes makes their lycopene into a form which is much easier for you to absorb, and so you get a lot more out of tomato sauce and cooked tomatoes, whereas in contrast, for example, broccoli is much better for you raw. Raw broccoli has 25 times the cancer-fighting compound as cooked broccoli. So these are reasons, all these little changes make a big difference and they add up. You know, when you've lost 90% of the phytochemicals of plants, these little changes can really make a big difference in your health over time. So that's why I've spent an entire chapter talking about what kinds of fruits and vegetables to eat and how to prepare them. And hopefully this gave you a good introduction to that. So we're going to switch gears to focus more on Ayurveda now. And The reason is that I use Ayurveda to personalize the diet for people in my practice, and I'm going to give you some introductory principles, and then we're going to talk about a few cases. So let me begin with the cases, and I'll come back to these. So these are patients who I've seen in my practice. So the first one was a 54-year-old woman who was a nurse who had struggled with fatigue, constipation, obesity, and she had already been eating paleo for 9 months. Now, her thyroid was a little bit off, so her thyroid-stimulating hormone was 3.7, which is considered normal, although maybe not optimal. And her free T4, which is one of her thyroid hormones, was in the low normal range. And she had this elevated thyroid antibody, which indicated an autoimmune process known as Hashimoto's disease. Basically, her body was attacking her thyroid and it was functioning less and less. And a couple of other hormone levels, her free T3 and total T3 were both low. And she went to her regular doctor. And so the standard of care when someone presents like this is you reassure them, you know, that they're fine. And she was told, just wait a few years, your thyroid will get worse, and then I'll prescribe you the medication. And then she was told to come back when she started feeling worse. And, you know, since she was a nurse, she was actually pretty well informed, and she just felt that that was not, you know, the right approach, so she came to us. And she didn't want to take any thyroid hormone, even the natural versions, which we sometimes prescribe, so she wanted me to work with her using Ayurveda. So we'll come back to that case. The second one is a young 32-year-old gentleman, software engineer, who had ulcerative colitis, which is an inflammation of the bowel, and it's also an autoimmune disease. And he was having problems with blood and mucus in the bowel movements. He also had been eating paleo for about a year. So his daily diet consisted of eggs, meat, vegetables, some yogurt and kefir, and fruits and nuts. And he was on a medication known as mesalamine, but he still had an elevated CRP, which is C-reactive protein, which is a marker of inflammation in the body. And his doctor was recommending Remicade, which is a strong immunosuppressant. And, you know, he just didn't want to go there yet. He was looking for other options. And he had actually eliminated gluten, so he was following a gluten-free diet, and that had reduced his symptoms by 20%, but he was still, you know, very symptomatic. And then the final case is a 46-year-old woman, and she was a homemaker, a mother of three, and she was struggling with chronic constipation and migraine headaches. And she was having migraines every month for the past 3 years, and there was no clear correlation with her menstrual cycle or specific foods. And she was on a class of medications known as triptans, which are the standard of care, the standard drug for treating migraines. But she was having to take them every month. And she was also struggling with constipation, with small bowel movements every 4 to 5 days. And she was told by her doctors to just hydrate better. So she was drinking lots of iced water and having salads every day. And this was part of her paleo diet. And she was on a medication known as Miralax, which is a common treatment for constipation. So we'll come back to those three cases after I give you an overview of Ayurveda. So the word Ayurveda comes from Sanskrit. Literally, it means the science of life. Ayu means life, and Veda meaning science. And it is one of the oldest systems of medicine. There's always controversy between Chinese medicine and Ayurveda about who's older. Depending on where the research was done. If it was done in India, they say Ayurveda is older. If the research from China says Chinese medicine is older. But Ayurveda really believes that diet is so fundamental, as illustrated by this quotation. When diet is wrong, medicine is of no use. But when diet is right, medicine is of no need. And it just illustrates how much weight diet carried in the Ayurvedic thinking. So the philosophy of Ayurveda came from the five elements concept of the universe, which we'll talk about in the next slide. And Ayurveda really believes in the body's self-healing ability, so the capacity of the body to heal itself. And it's a science that emphasizes qualities. So Whereas Western medicine is very quantitative, Ayurveda is highly qualitative. And Ayurveda definitely believes every person is unique and that diet and lifestyle should be individualized, but also tailored to the local environment and season. So the principle of eat local was, you know, one of the key principles of Ayurvedic nutrition. So these five elements are here. They are space, air, fire, water, and earth. And within the body, these five elements combine to form three doshas. So the doshas are the three forces or principles in the body that control all functions of the body. And these are vata, which you can think of as wind, pitta, which you can think of as fire, and kapha, which you can think of as earth. And we're going to talk about each of these in more detail, but basically the five elements combine to form these three doshas, and the three doshas are what's most important in terms of the bodily functions. So every person is born with a unique combination of these three doshas, and this is what comprises the body type. So everyone has a unique body type, and it's the balance between the doshas that ultimately leads to health and the imbalance that leads to disease. And doshas may have both positive and negative associated emotions. So when the dosha is in balance, it can manifest with positive, you know, qualities, but when it's out of balance, can lead to negative emotions. So let's start with vata. So vata dosha is the energy associated with movement and controls all movement in the body, including the heartbeat, respiration, nerve impulses. And vata has the qualities of wind. So just like wind, it's light, cold, and dry. And in terms of the emotional aspect, it's associated in a positive way with creativity and rapid thinking. But when it's out of balance, it can be associated with anxiety, fear, and restlessness. And remember, we said Ayurveda is a qualitative system. So the important thing to remember are the qualities of vata, light, cold, and dry. So a program to balance vata would have the opposite qualities. So with diet, for example, it would be heavy, warm, and moist would be the qualities of foods to balance the vata dosha. Now, second is pitta dosha, which is fire. And this is the associated with metabolism, digestion, and absorption of food. And so pitta has the qualities of fire, which are hot, sharp, penetrating, and intense. So this would be the opposite of vata, where a pitta balancing program would focus on cooling foods and energetically foods that have the opposite quality to pitta. And so pitta is linked closely to agni, which is the digestive capacity or digestive fire. And in terms of the positive aspects of pitta, it's associated with intelligence and insight, but when out of balance, it can be associated with anger and irritability. And lastly, there's kapha, which is the force that is associated with body structure and strength and associated with structural elements like the joints, bones, ligaments, and lubrication of joints. And kapha has the qualities of earth, so it is heavy, cool, slow, and damp. And in a positive light, associated with love and calmness, but when out of balance, associated with attachment, depression, and sluggishness or inertia. So the first principle of Ayurvedic treatment is that the doshas should be restored to their original levels. So there's a questionnaire I have in my book, which you can fill out. It has 20 items that gives you an idea about what your doshas are. And remember, there's three of them, vata, pitta, and kapha. And this is, of course, a very oversimplified version of Ayurveda, but at least it gives you a starting point to apply the principles. So let's say, for example, you fill out the questionnaire and you end up with your answers are 50% in the pitta column, 30% in the vata column, and 20% in the kapha. Then in that case, your primary dosha would be pitta, and you would follow the pitta balancing program. And every person has usually a primary and the secondary. And the goal is not to get equal amounts of all three. So in that example, you're not trying to get 33% vata, 33% pitta, 33% kapha. You're trying to actually go back to your original combination, which may be, you know, whatever the case, 50% pitta, 30% vata, 20% kapha. So you're trying to return to that. And most people are, you know, usually somewhat out of balance. So the goal is to return to your original combination, if that makes sense. Now, what causes the dosha imbalance? Well, it could be all of the things that are part of evolutionary mismatch. So our diet, lifestyle, social isolation, stress, environmental toxins, etc. And disease is very much individualized. So one other thing I want to mention is that if you end up with two columns that are the same, so let's say you're filling out the questionnaire and you come out about equal, you know, vata and pitta, and kapha is really low, then what would you do? Because vata and pitta have, you know, very different programs. In that case, Ayurveda would say to tailor it to the season. So during the fall and winter, which are more vata-provoking seasons, you would follow a vata program. And during the spring and summer, which are more pitta-provoking seasons because they're warmer, you'd follow the pitta-balancing program. So if you have two primary doshas, then that's kind of the recommendation. So let's go back to the cases and illustrate how Ayurveda was applied to help these people. So first we talked about the nurse who was 54 who had fatigue, constipation, obesity, and had the low thyroid, but she wasn't at the point where she would qualify for thyroid medication. And yet she was struggling and suffering with all of these symptoms. So she had what is called in Western medicine subclinical hypothyroidism, meaning that it's at the point where it's not overt hypothyroidism, but it's still diagnosable. And the treatment in Western medicine is basically just waiting. But from an Ayurvedic perspective, I assessed her and found that she had very high kapha. And so I had her follow a kapha-reducing diet. And in Western medicine, the thyroid is like the engine of metabolism, and so it's very much associated with agni, which is digestive fire in Ayurveda. So we talked about strategies to increase her agni. I recommended an herb to her known as ashwagandha, which is an Ayurvedic herb that helps with strengthening thyroid function and also with reducing the excess kapha. And after 3 months of these simple dietary changes and some natural treatments, her thyroid function, her hormone level improved by about 40%, and her thyroid stimulating hormone fell below 3, which is considered normal. So her numbers were actually normalizing after 3 months on this Ayurvedic regimen. And she began to also lose some weight, and she had enough energy that she was able to start exercising, which was the main problem beforehand, was she was too tired to even exercise. But after losing some weight and noticing her improved energy, so one of the main symptoms of low thyroid is fatigue. So as her thyroid function improved, she was able to get more energy, exercise, lose weight, and then gradually she's been able to maintain her, you know, normal thyroid function now for a number of years. So the second case we talked about was the individual with ulcerative colitis with the inflammation in the GI tract. So as you remember, he was already eating paleo. He was eating primarily meat, eggs, vegetables, and dairy on most days. And so in his case, after assessing him, I diagnosed him with excess pitta. So remember, pitta is the fire dosha, and it's associated with inflammation, which was his main complaint. It was an inflammatory bowel disease. And now he was eating paleo, but his diet had a lot of foods with a very hot quality, according to Ayurveda, which classifies every food in, you know, the qualitative sense. So the meat, eggs, and dairy were very warming to his body, which was already in a high pitta state. And therefore, even though he was eating paleo, he was actually, you know, not improving. So I had him change his diet and actually take out the meat, eggs, and dairy and focus on just greens and fruits for several weeks. So even though meat, eggs, and dairy are very nutrient-dense foods, and I often recommend them, in his particular case, I think they were doing more harm than good. So I had him incorporate turmeric, you know, liberally in his diet, and turmeric is one of the spices that's the most powerful, you know, anti-inflammatory. And after 3 months, he reported that the blood and mucus in his stool had resolved and his bowel movements were actually better. And after about a year, Ayurvedic treatment works very slowly. So it took about 1 year, but he was able to wean off of his medication and remain diet controlled for most of his, the next several years. And then finally, the third case was the woman, stay-at-home mom with three kids, who was having constipation and chronic migraines for the past 3 years. And she was hydrating with the iced water and having salads every day. So you can probably guess that this is a patient who had excess vata. So remember, the qualities of vata dosha are light, cold, and dry. And in her case, she had been drinking the iced water and eating salads, which are considered very cold and dry in Ayurveda, and they were exacerbating her high vata. So I had her switch to a vata pacifying diet, which is basically warming foods, qualitatively warming foods that are eaten hot. And then I had her stop eating salads and avoid the iced water. So the vata dosha is one where raw foods are encouraged to be in moderation, or sometimes avoid it if you have an imbalance with excess vata. So in her case, I had her just switch to cooked vegetables and completely avoid salads and incorporate more good fats because of the lot of dryness in her system, such as ghee, olive oil, avocados, and sesame oil. And within 3 months of these changes, she reported that her digestion was completely normal, her constipation had resolved, and her migraines reduced by 50%. So it just illustrates that Ayurveda can have a really big impact just with simple changes in diet and lifestyle. And I hope these three cases have illustrated that for you. So in order to get a better sense of your Ayurvedic body type, you can complete the 20-item questionnaire in my book and get some recommendations incorporating the evolutionary ancestral perspective. As we talked about, certain body types can do well vegetarian. Other body types, you know, should eat some or no raw food, etc. Those are some examples of recommendations. And the great thing about Ayurveda is its focus is prevention. And there's different prevention for each person. So depending on your body type, you might need to do something different to prevent illness than someone with a different body type, different doshas. So that's the real strength of Ayurveda, is the individualized recommendations for prevention and staying healthy. Now, in closing, I'm just going to review a couple of other elements of the Paleo-Vedic approach, which are the detoxification and the spices. So first, detoxification. Well, why is that important? It's because now in our modern world, there's over 70,000 chemicals that are used in our daily life in low levels, and chronic low-level exposure is the norm for all of us, and really, a lot of research has not been done in terms of the long-term consequences of this, so there's a lot of benefits to detoxification. So what is one simple food you can incorporate to help with this? And these are beet greens, so the leafy tops of the beetroot. Here's a picture I took at my local market with some organic beet greens. And one thing about beets is that the greens are usually the first part to wilt and go bad. So typically, once that happens, they're cut off and then the root is sold. So if you want the freshest beets, you can buy them with the greens still on. And the greens are actually much richer in antioxidants than the root. And these have 50 times more antioxidant activity than carrots. So very high in antioxidants. And they're a rich source of a compound known as trimethylglycine, which supports methylation and liver function, and these are important for detoxification in the body. They also contain anti-inflammatory nutrients, so help with reducing inflammation in the body. And beets have unique compounds known as betalains, which are cancer-fighting, and these are not found in any other vegetable, so they're unique to beets. And, of course, they're very rich in folate, fiber, and potassium. So there's a lot of advantages to incorporating them, and these compounds are not harmed by cooking. So you can cook beet greens just like you would cook any other leafy greens like spinach or kale. You can cook them, or you can have them raw, or you can juice them. But it's a very good option for helping your body with detoxification. And like that, there are many other foods that can help with just daily detoxification, which is something I do recommend. And lastly, with spices, there's a few reasons why spices are really excellent. And they are the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet, second only to organ meats, which a lot of us don't like the taste of. And some of the benefits of spices are they're extremely rich in antioxidants, they reduce inflammation, they help your digestion, and Ayurveda believes that all disease starts in the gut, so digestion is really the foundation of good health, and they help with metabolism and blood sugar. So these are the four main issues in our modern diet, you know, the inflammatory nature, the low levels of antioxidants, the high levels of sugar. So spices actually counteract all of those things. And this is why I believe they have a really important role in our modern diets. And there's a group of 12 spices, which I call the kitchen pharmacy, which are the most powerful healing spices. And so some of them you might know, including turmeric and ginger, cinnamon, fenugreek, clove, allspice, coriander, fennel, saffron, cumin, and curry leaf, and others. And the main thing with spices is that the research has shown that you don't need to take a supplement or have really high doses. You just need to cook every day or regularly with them in small amounts. So that cooking quantity, the culinary quantities of spices have been shown to be very beneficial for health. So you just don't need to be intimidated. Just try some of the recipes which I have talked about. And finally, I want to remind you that healthy eating should be fun. So here's a picture of my daughter, Alicia, and she's eating a pomelo for the first time. And she uses all of her senses, and you know, whenever she's eating a food, and just a great teacher for me. So please keep in touch. I do maintain a blog at my website, drakhil.com, and you can also follow me on social media at Dr. Akhil. So I want to thank you all for your attention and your time tonight.
Okay, we have some questions. The first one is, a lot of Ayurvedic medicine, instructs you to consume herbal remedies with milk and honey. How would this work in a paleo-Vedic diet?
Okay, yeah, that's a really good question. I think in my view, dairy products are not excluded, you know, with the paleo diet. So many people think, okay, dairy is not part of the paleo diet, but I think fermented dairy and, you know, healthy, full-fat dairy is definitely acceptable, so I don't have any issue with that. And then honey as well is often used to amplify the effects of certain herbs and spices. And I think, you know, honey is definitely a sweetener that was consumed for, you know, for millennia. So I think I have no objection to the use of honey in moderation as long as the rest of your diet is very balanced.
Okay. Next question. Where do things stand as far as developing customized, that's in quotes, probiotic formulas tailored to specific needs of a patient, e.g. a Parkinson's patient might be deficient in certain good probiotic strains or have overabundance in other bad strains?
Yeah, that's a great question. So with probiotics, I think our understanding is really just in its infancy. So we're starting to understand that different diseases are associated with different deficiencies in probiotics. But I think in terms of getting to that level of customized probiotics and knowing which one is the best for each individual, we're probably like 5-10 years away. But I'm excited about the research that's ongoing.
And there's on that same note, the next one of the questions is, can we bring diversity back to the microbiota and how? And I think
yes.
You might have.
Well, absolutely. Okay. So it's very simple. The problem was the lack of diversity in the plant foods. So if you just increase the diversity of the, you know, fruits and vegetables you're eating, that automatically increases the diversity of your microbiome. Every food feeds a different bacterium. So just try to seek out, you know, fruits and vegetables you may not normally eat. And then you want to avoid all the things which can worsen your microbiome, you know, like antibiotics and overuse of, those antibacterial hand sanitizers and those kind of things. So, but diet is the best way to increase the diversity.
Okay. Does roasting or grilling vegetables retain more of the nutrients than steaming? How much of the beneficial nutrients are lost when grilling, roasting versus eating vegetables raw?
Great question. I think that in general, having vegetables raw or steaming is basically a good way to go. I think if you're boiling vegetables, you lose all the nutrients in the boiling water. And then roasting or grilling at high temperatures, I mean, it depends on the vegetable. So with tomatoes, you're actually improving their digestibility and their nutrition. So it really is on a case-by-case basis, but I would say, you know, low temperature cooking is slightly preferred to high temperature for most vegetables.
Okay. Have you seen success in treating autoimmune diseases like SLE with Ayurveda? And then the follow-up to the same question is, what is the best way to get a consultation with you?
Yes. So I think, autoimmune disease is definitely one of the fastest growing categories, and there are ways to treat it using Ayurveda. It's not simple, but it does take time. And, you know, I do see patients in my office, and we have several physicians working together at my clinic, the Institute for Health and Healing. So we're definitely open to working with people with autoimmune disease.
Okay. Can a juicer be helpful even though we lose the fiber?
So with juicing, I think it's ideal if you can keep the fiber. You know, there are juicers where you don't lose the fiber, but if you are, you know, losing the fiber, I think it's not ideal because many of the phytochemicals are in the fiber, and it still does give you some, you know, nutrients, but I think it's really ideal to either eat the whole vegetable or include the fiber.
Okay. What do you think of the Keystone diet?
I'm not familiar with that. Oh, ketone diet.
Oh,
yeah.
Ketone?
Oh, ketone.
Okay, I hadn't heard of Keystone either.
Okay.
Ketone. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So the in general, the ketogenic diet or the ketone diet is very powerful, and there's a lot of exciting research in the areas of cancer and, you know, other diseases in treating it. I think that there's also research with brain injuries using that, and you know, a lot of benefits for weight loss as well. So I think there's a lot of positive aspects to that diet.
I have a couple questions since I have a couple more minutes. What about how much time do you spend in your practice chatting about prebiotics, because I know everybody talks about probiotics, but what about, you know, Jerusalem artichokes and chicory and all the prebiotics that feed the probiotics? And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So that's a great question. The differences between probiotics and prebiotics. So basically, this all relates to the microbiome, which is the gut bacteria we all have that control our immune system and, you know, blood sugar, metabolism. So they're just so important. And the probiotics are actually supplements that have the bacteria, good bacteria in them. And the prebiotics are food for the bacteria. So they actually raise your own levels of good bacteria by growing them. And the studies show that actually the prebiotics are probably the more effective way long-term to really improve the microbiome. So a lot of the lasting changes to the microbiome result from prebiotics. And probiotics have more short-term effects, so they might change your immune function, they might shift the microbiome, and those are all, you know, very beneficial, but they may not last in a long-term sense the same way that prebiotics affect the microbiome. So I think depending on the condition, you know, probably a combination is effective, but prebiotics, again, are food-based, so that's always the best long-term strategy.
And then lastly, and then I'm going to walk up and close the program, but what about, you've mentioned turmeric quite a few times, but doesn't
but I haven't heard any. What about black pepper? Doesn't that make turmeric much more bioavailable?
Yes,
or is that true?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, having turmeric with black pepper actually increases the absorption of turmeric by 2,000%. So it's interesting because in traditional Indian cooking, you in curries, you're always combining black pepper and turmeric. And the absorption of turmeric is pretty low. So it's as a spice, when you're cooking with it, not much of it is absorbed. However, that doesn't mean that it's not helpful. It still has a lot of anti-inflammatory effects and other benefits, even though it's not absorbed. But as Patty was saying, if you combine just a pinch of black pepper, you don't need to have a lot of black pepper, but even a pinch of black pepper with turmeric, increases the absorption 20 times. And then if you have any kind of systemic inflammation within, any organ, then it's probably best to use a supplement because the extracts of turmeric are absorbed much, much more than the powder, the spice. But if you're using the spice for cooking, just combining it with black pepper is really the best way to increase the absorption. So.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your program. Wasn't that great, everybody? Yeah. We also thank our audiences here, our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion is now adjourned.